the headlines. North Korea fires multiple missiles, including an intercontinental ballistic one a day after the U.S. president wraps up his Asia tour. Afghan health experts warn about the deteriorating health system in the country where people are dying from lack of medicine. And in Texas, a mass shooting at an elementary school leaves 19 children and 2 adults dead. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. North Korea ramps up its missile tests, reportedly firing several short and long-range projectiles in a single day amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea and Japan say 3 missiles, including one that appeared to be an ICBM, were fired in the early hours of Wednesday. Seoul and Tokyo have called the launches provocative. South Korea's military says it has, in response, held a joint drill with American forces without giving any details. North Korea has conducted a flurry of missile tests, including its largest ICBM this year. The launch has happened just a day after U.S. President Joe Biden wrapped up his Asia trip, during which he agreed to new measures to deter the nuclear-armed North. A White House official says Biden has been briefed on the latest launches. Meanwhile, the South Korean defense chief has, in a phone call with his U.S. counterpart, called for an early deployment of American strategic assets in his country. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, explains why exactly North Korea keeps working on its missile technology despite all the denuclearization talks from the U.S. Let's take a listen.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un promised then-president of the United States, Donald Trump, that Pyongyang would refrain from long-range missile testing and nuclear testing so long as the U.S. dropped its hostile policy. Really, the U.S. didn't come forward with any negotiations with North Korea, kept North Korea under United Nations Security Council sanctions. North Korea then sort of gave perhaps the Biden administration a bit of time to come forward, and now with the conservative Yoon Suk-yeol government here in the South, we can see that patience really has kind of run out from the North, with analysts suggesting now North Korea really isn't going to look for any sort of denuclearization talks, but is likely to maintain a nuclear deterrence against what it sees as U.S. aggression.
Afghan health experts are sounding the alarm over the deteriorating healthcare system in their country. They say Afghanistan will soon run out of medicines if urgent action is not taken. Rahmatullah Balban reports from Kabul.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low, and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The United States has just seen one of its deadliest school shootings in years. A gunman has killed 19 children and two adults at an elementary school in the state of Texas. The suspect has been identified as an 18-year-old man. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the suspect is also dead, apparently killed by police officers in the town of Uvalde. Reports say the gunman drove up to the school and entered with a rifle and a handgun. The carnage follows a series of mass shootings in the United States this month. Despite recurring mass casualty shootings, multiple initiatives to reform gun regulations have failed in Congress, leaving states and local councils to enact their own restrictions. And a report by the FBI revealed that the U.S. experienced 61 active shooter incidents in 2021, showing a sharp rise over 2020 and the highest tally in more than 20 years. The European Union remains split on imposing an oil embargo on Russia, with Hungary signaling that it won't back the proposal. In a letter to the EU chief Charles Michel, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said it appears unlikely that a comprehensive solution should be found before the special meeting of the EU is held later this month. Diplomatic sources say sanctions on Russian oil will be on the agenda during the summit. The Hungarian Prime Minister says banning Russia's oil would only deepen internal divisions and offer no realistic solution to tackle them. Hungary has already imposed a new state of emergency, citing the war in Ukraine. The Ukrainian lawmaker says Russian forces are seeking to encircle Ukrainian troops in twin eastern cities from three directions in an attempt to control the Donbass region. This as the war between the two neighbors now drags into its fourth month. Musa Magomedov says Russian forces keep bombing Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in Donetsk and Luhansk provinces in totally inhuman fashion. He says the attacks are causing civilian deaths. Ukraine's military general staff has also said that Russia is using aircraft to support its ground forces. Earlier, President Volodymyr Zelensky warned that Moscow is seeking to destroy the industrial Donbass region, where it has now focused its attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to the allegations. On Tuesday, the Russian Defense Minister, however, said that Moscow is deliberately slowing its offensive to allow civilians to evacuate. Russian forces have already taken control of three towns in the Donetsk region, including Svitlodarsk. Another Palestinian youth has been killed by Israeli regime troops following intense clashes with Israeli settlers near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian media say the 16-year-old Qaith Rafir Yamin was shot in the head after hundreds of settlers stormed the tomb of Prophet Joseph near the city. Violent clashes then erupted between Palestinian youths and Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Red Crescent says over 75 people have been injured. A resistance group based in the West Bank city of Jenin says its forces have shot and injured a number of Israeli troops who accompanied the settlers. Hamas has also issued a statement blaming Israel for the escalation of tensions in the West Bank. Iran's foreign minister says the country will use all its legal and international capacities to prosecute those involved in the assassination of an IRGC member in Tehran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in the message to the family of Colonel Hassan Saeed Khodai, who was assassinated on Sunday. He said the assassination proved that Iran is in the forefront of the fight against terrorism. Amir Abdullahian said Iran has been also a regular victim of state terrorism. The foreign minister censured the silence of certain countries that falsely claim to be fighting terror and advocating human rights. The IRGC's top commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has vowed Iran's response will be tough and make the enemies regret their heinous crime. Earlier, we reached out to political commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh for his take on this matter. He explains why Iran is well within its legal rights to respond to the act of terrorism.
Definitely this is going to be responded. Some people might think that how about previous operations? Iran has always vowed to take revenge, and they might have questions if this has happened ever. Well, Iran and Iranian officials, especially the top military, are not in the habit of acknowledging responsibility for operations. And when you hear the Israelis claim responsibility, it's not their officials, but it's their media in order to escape responsibility, because this is a clear case of assassination and terror, and it should be condemned. I mean, the Israelis should be condemned for that. And when the UN fails, other countries fail to condemn and punish Israel, then according to the international rules and regulations, Iran has every right to take retaliation.
Iranians have marked the 40th anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr. The occasion is marked every year as a decisive moment that changed the fate of the 1980s Iran-Iraq war. Yusuf Jalali reports from Khorramshahr.
It's just another day in Iran's southwestern city of Khorramshahr, with a call to prayer resonating from the city's main mosque, Masjid Jame. But 40 years ago, on this day, the mosque was witness to a historic moment that changed the course of the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. It was the day when the city was recaptured from the Iraqi forces after 19 months. War veteran Abdul Saheb still recalls what he refers to as the decisive day.
The liberation of Khorramshahr was one of the greatest moments for Iran in its war with Iraq. Khorramshahr was a highly strategic city, both geographically and economically, as it was and still is a major port city with oil and gas reserves. Iraq used all its force to occupy the city, but lost to our people's resistance.
Khorramshahr was the first city that was captured by Iraq shortly after the onset of a war that took a marathon 8 years, only to end in a ceasefire, with no gains for Iraq. Then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein enjoyed full military support from the West, believing to capture Khorramshahr only in 3 hours.
Saddam thought in vain that he would be able to take control of Khorramshahr in 3 hours, but the resistance of our brave men and women made it take 45 days to occupy only two-thirds of the city. So Saddam and his Western supporters, with all their advanced weapons, faced our people's steadfastness.
But the strategic port city of Khorramshahr was finally captured by Iraq in October 1980. After an eventful 576 days, the city was liberated in May 1982 during Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, which forced Iraqis to retreat to the border.
During Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, we entirely repulsed Iraqis from Khorramshahr. It was a heavy defeat not only for Iraq, but for the West, which has stood with the aggressors. During the successful operation, we captured up to 19,000 Iraqi troops and a substantial amount of Iraqi military hardware in Khorramshahr.
Once known as the Bride of the Middle East, Khorramshahr today has turned into a symbol of resistance in Iran. While some of the bullet-riddled walls are still kept untouched, everywhere else in the city, there's a sign that reminds passersby of the May 24th resistance.
The liberation of Khorramshahr went down in history as a turning point in the Iran-Iraq war that changed the fate of the war and stopped the Iraqi forces from making further incursions into the Iranian soil. That's why Iranians still remember the decisive moment to honor those who made it happen. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Khorramshahr.
The Yemeni army says it has shot down a Saudi drone over the capital, Sana'a. It says the incident is the latest violation of the UN-brokered truce, which will expire in a week, amid efforts to extend it. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hudaydah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
A vocal minority in the U.S. are demanding not gun bans, but book bans, trying to suppress the teaching of the U.S. deep-seated systematic racism. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan, writers. This article is published under the heading The Buffalo Massacre, Banning Books, and Systematic Racism. Stay tuned for more. 10 people were slaughtered in Buffalo recently, killed at a supermarket in the heart of the black community. The gunman, an 18-year-old self-professed white supremacist armed with a legally purchased Bushmaster AR-15 style semi-automatic rifle. His goal, based on rambling, poisonous 180-page document he posted online, was to kill as many blacks as possible. Of the 13 victims, including 3 who were injured, 11 were African-American. The killer live-streamed the massacre on the social media video website Twitch. While the Amazon-owned site pulled down the gruesome video within minutes, it was immediately posted, then accessed by millions on other internet platforms. Challenging racist violence demands an understanding of U.S. true history. Instead, a vocal minority in the U.S. are demanding not gun bans, but book bans, trying to suppress the teaching of U.S. deep-seated systematic racism. The Buffalo shooter espoused a conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement, which wrongly posits that traditional native-born white majorities are being replaced by people of color, immigrants, and Muslims, aided and abetted by a left-wing globalist elite. This new population, the racist replacement theory maintains, compliantly votes according to the dictates of their supposed Democratic Party sponsors. The killer, who is in custody, directed his animus at replacers, as he called them, principally African Americans. His slapdash screed, which borrows heavily from another one posted by the racist mass murderer who perpetrated the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque massacres in 2019, betrays a profound ignorance of the history and racism in the United States of America. Abram X. Kendi, founding director of Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research, warned on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, this crisis of white supremacist domestic terror is likely to get worse. Studies have shown that anti-racist education, that anti-racist books serve in a protective fashion, particularly for white youth when they are exposed to white supremacy, because through learning about the history of white supremacy, they are better able to recognize it. Several of Kendi's books have been banned or targeted for removal from school curricula and libraries, including the National Book Award-winning Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Texas Senator Ted Cruz drove Kendi's children's book, Anti-Racist Baby, onto bestseller list after denouncing it and several other books during the Senate confirmation hearings of African-American Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. Professor Kendi continued, anti-racist education, first and foremost, is teaching children about the history of white supremacist ideology, the role that white supremacist ideology played in racial slavery, in settler colonialism, in Jim Crow. It's teaching children U.S. racial reality so that they can see that, though Americans look different, though Americans maybe speak differently, they are all equals, but the cause of these inequities are indeed racism. The domestic terrorist in this case reportedly chose Buffalo after searching zip codes close to his overwhelmingly white hometown of Conklin, New York. He then traveled several hours to Buffalo's Kingsley neighborhood and targeted the Tops Friendly Market on Jefferson Avenue. Why the supermarket? India Walton, a former Buffalo mayoral candidate and senior strategic organizer with the progressive organization Roots Action, explained on Democracy Now. We know that 80% of the population of the east side of Buffalo are people of color, are black people specifically, and they have one place to shop. We have dubbed it food apartheid because it is a policy decision. The fact that there is no food on the east side of Buffalo and there is not the availability of these basic services is a policy choice. There are people who actively chose to not provide services in this community. For a long time, we've been told that this stops on Jefferson. We are lucky to have it because no one else wants to come into the neighborhood. The Buffalo mass murderer also considered additional targets, either a church or a school. According to online chats attributed to him, he feared the school would have too much security. Fortunately, he was stopped at the supermarket. White supremacists are making the case that it's the people of color, that they're the source of their pain, which is something that many of these young white male supremacists are being indoctrinated on, groomed on, and thereby carrying out mass shootings. Abraham X. Kendi said, adding, "This is only going to get worse if we don't get a handle on it." Limiting access to guns and expanding access to education about the role of racism in the U.S. society and learning, as Abraham X. Kendi's book title suggests, how to be an anti-racist are fundamental steps to stem the horror of hate and heal these long festering wounds.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
President Biden has announced that the U.S. would respond militarily if China attacked Taiwan. China said in response that no country should underestimate its firm resolve and strong ability to protect its sovereign and territorial interests. Beijing also urged Washington to stop saying or doing things in violation of the One China principle. China has also threatened those who play with fire will certainly burn themselves. The United States and China are already at odds over a myriad of issues as regards technology, trade, Hong Kong, and South China Sea. Now, what about Taiwan? Are the two powers heading for a collision over Taiwan? Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests in tonight's episode of The Spotlight. We'll have retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and former Pentagon analyst Karen Kiatowski from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also, a spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, joining us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Let's begin with Karen. Good to have you with us. So American war planners had previously left the question of U.S. defending Taiwan against Chinese aggression unanswered. But now you have President Biden openly saying that his country will take military action in that case. So does he really mean it? What has changed?
It's hard to say if he means it or not. I think actually the president does mean it. He imagines himself to be a king, I think. And I don't think he reads the small print. I don't think he understands the agreements. He is a person who likes to use threatening language, and he uses it.
Mm-hmm. And then we have this state-run Chinese newspaper, The Global Times, saying that Biden's remarks are not gaffes, but dangerous signals that the U.S. intends to drop support of the One China policy. So how do you see the future relations between Washington and Beijing?
The current relations aren't as good as they should be, and the future relations could very well get worse. And I think part of what Biden is indicating and why his staff is allowing him to indicate these things is to actually create a kind of ambiguity beyond the normal support of One China policy, but an ambiguity on the use of military force. And the question was asked of the president this time. This is the third time in 9 months that he has made such a statement about coming to the full defense of Taiwan. And all three times the staff has walked him back from that. But this question recently was in context of the Ukrainian defense, the $40 billion that were just the United States Congress just gave to or voted to give to Ukraine, and also the $20 billion before that, it has already been committed to Ukraine. So this is a large military response, and that's what Biden is imagining that he would do in a case of Taiwan. I think in his mind, he would do that.
Okay. Now, Harley is also joining us from Germany. Harley, good to have you with us. So this state-owned paper, the Global Times in China, is saying that China-U.S. relationship is like Titanic, and it's heading for an iceberg. I wonder if you agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. And it's almost entirely the fault of the war party in the United States. We've seen an escalation of rhetoric regarding Russia in Ukraine, and now we're seeing the same thing in China. The intention after the withdrawal from Afghanistan was to carry out a pivot to Asia, which includes the Quad, which includes the idea of an Asian NATO, which included the AUKUS agreement, the Australia-UK-US nuclear sub-agreement. You have Admiral Richard, the chairman of STRATCOM, saying that the US is now more likely to use nuclear weapons than it had been in the past. There's an illusion that exists within the top advisors around Biden, which is that U.S. military power is invincible. And I think they actually are working on war plans for limited nuclear war, preemptive strikes with Russia and China. And in our view, it's completely insane. But it is this view of the unipolar world that the U.S. can dictate with its NATO allies, who really don't bring much to the table except for the British, who actually are part of the crafting of these plans.
Mm-hmm. Harley, we had this reporter asking President Biden that the U.S. did not get involved in Ukraine militarily. What if Taiwan is attacked? And then Biden says, yes, the U.S. would take military action in that case. Now, this is while on his recent Asian trip, he signed agreements with a dozen countries to join the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. So doesn't this send some kind of mixed signals? I mean, speaking of war, at the same time clinching trade deals in Asia, what's Washington's agenda in Asia?
Well, first of all, no deals were actually signed. There are no agreements. It was an agreement to reach an agreement, the so-called Indo-Pacific agreement. A number of the Asian nations are hesitant because they're watching what the U.S. is doing in Ukraine, where, look, I would say the U.S. is virtually a co-belligerent. The weapons that are being delivered have made a bit of a difference to help Ukraine. But more importantly, they're trying to bleed Russia. I think the same intention exists with China. But you have to realize the issue of trade is a phony issue. If the U.S. wanted more trade in Asia, it could join the Belt and Road Initiative. It's been invited to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What it's trying to do is contain China and stop China's aggressive commitment to infrastructure and development. And that's because the whole Western financial system depends on cheap labor and cheap raw resources from the poorer countries of the world.
All right. Let's turn to Harley now. Harley, I want you to answer the same question, please. It's an important one. Let our viewers know your opinion about what Washington's true intention is and what's the plan for Asia.
Well, the plan is to stop China. The intention is to make sure that you can continue favorable trade agreements for the United States, in other words, for global corporations from the United States to get cheap labor agreements, to get a supply chain from poorer Asian countries. But the Chinese, which used to do that, have changed. And that's a significant change. Now, the second significant change is the China-Russia agreement. The fact that China and Russia are agreeing not just on military, but on economic policy. You know, one of the important things, and I know many people in Iran know this, one of the important aspects shaping Western policy is the idea of preventing an alliance between Eurasian economic development and Europe. And this is what the Ukraine situation is about, and this is what the China situation is about.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to British geopolitics and Mackinder in 1904, and the fact that Russia and China are integrating Eurasia with Eastern Europe, or Russia, and that this is very attractive to people in Germany who otherwise are suffering under the sanctions policy. If Germany were to join with Russia and China, it would be game over for the City of London and Wall Street to be able to dictate economic terms globally.
Okay, Karen, you know that Washington has a close relationship with Taiwan, but officially it pursues, the One China policy, and President Biden also confirmed this. Now, there is no official ties between the U.S. and Taiwan, but Washington sells weapons to Taiwan. It has, great trade relations with it. Is this not contradictory to the One China principle that Washington is saying that it's sticking with?
It is. It is somewhat contradictory, but, there's money to be made in Taiwan, and it certainly serves an American purpose to irritate China in that regard. I wanted to agree with what Farley said and mm-hmm. add one thing to it as far as the nuclear
sure.
threat. Biden, after this, went to South Korea and renewed a statement of shared defense, and for the first time ever used the word nuclear in his range of weapons that we would use to defend South Korea. So this idea that nuclear war is being planned for is well documented. Of course, the Pentagon has published documents, RAND Corporation has published documents on the winnability of a nuclear war. But this is clearly something that is out there. Biden is talking about it. He is hinting at it. And I think we have to take him seriously. I am concerned, of course, that Washington is willing to blow up the entire world to destroy it, to achieve its aims.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, let's also talk a little bit about the so-called Quad Group, the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. And, this has kind of alarmed Beijing. What's the plan?
I think, the world is changing. We've got the multipolar power sharing future, which the United States is unwilling to really cope with. We're not going to tolerate that, or Washington, D.C. is not going to. So much of what passes for our foreign policy is really a war against a multipolar world, which cannot be stopped. It's already well down the road, not just with military cooperation, economic cooperation, but also financial cooperation, which we're seeing right now in with China and Russia and many of the other countries in dealing with U.S. sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Harley, Chinese President Xi Jinping has said that reunification between China and Taiwan is inevitable, and he refused to rule out the use of force. So what's the prospect like for the two countries?
Well, I think the Chinese do not want to have a war over Taiwan. There were significant developments of improved trade relations, economic investment in Taiwan from China, mutual cooperation in artificial intelligence and other areas. But this, as Karen was saying, this irritates Washington, which seems to believe that all trade must flow from Washington and London, or from Wall Street and London. And the fact that China has become a major economic power is the real problem, because the unipolar world, which people in Washington swear loyalty to, is based on the idea that no other country can dictate terms of trade. And the idea of the Great Reset is an intention of putting all the power in the hands of central banks, which really represent private banks and private corporate cartels. And the idea that China can work with poorer countries, as in Africa, in South Asia, even in Latin America. In the Caribbean nations are opening ties with China, and the State Department is going crazy over this. So It really is the emergence of a multipolar world. It's unstoppable. The only thing they can do is blow it up. And I think that's why you're seeing a reaction, which I think from Washington is seen in many capitals as panic over losing the unipolar world, and over the fact that with inflation, with supply chain problems and other things, the Western economies are in terrible shape.
Now let me put the same question to Karen. Karen, what do you see on the horizon for China and Taiwan? Would there be a war, or would there be reunification at any price, like President Xi Jinping is saying?
I don't see reunification. I agree with Harley. I think between those two are to come together to have trade. Even as China, despite some of the things we've seen with the COVID-19 response, even China is in some ways listening to its people more, that kind of thing. Being a more integrated democracy, it's not a democracy, but they listen to their people. So it's not even the stereotypical dictatorship or communist state anymore. That doesn't exist over there in that regard. So I think a peaceful coming together and a profitable coming together is down the road, but I think it'll take a lot of time. You're talking, honestly, generational. If you don't do it via war, you have to do it when the culture itself changes. And I think that culture is changing, and it's going to take time. And I'm sure the Chinese are willing to wait for that.
And Harley, China and Russia conducted joint military drills today. It lasted 13 hours. Of course, they're saying that this is routine practice. So what signal does that send to Washington and its allies in Asia?
Well, you know, I was talking to some people around the Pentagon recently, and they acknowledged that their whole plan for military confrontation was always based on the idea of either war with Russia or war with China, but not a two-front war. And this, of course, blows everything out of the water for them, because the idea that the United States would have to carry out operations in the Pacific and with Russia, it doesn't work. I mean, the United States had trouble maintaining forces and control in Afghanistan. So I think the problem that people in Washington have is that they tend to see things as military first. The February 4th meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping was primarily about economic integration, a coordination. And the military was secondary, but they knew that if they came closer together economically, it would provoke a reaction from the U.S. and NATO against them. And so, of necessity, they have to be prepared militarily. But it's also clear that Washington's policies are driving much of the rest of the world into a distrust of the dollar and the U.S. You know, the U.S. just stole $30 billion from Russia. China is trying to figure out how to pull some of its investments in the United States out before it faces the same kind of problem. So in all of this, Washington is the problem. And I think unless something changes dramatically, and of course you have a bipartisan consensus on these policies in Washington, we may be in it for a long, long war.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests. We had retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and former Pentagon analyst Karen Kwiatkowski from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also, spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, joined us from Potsdam, Germany. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أول عوض الحليم من حلمه أن الناس أنصاره على الجهل.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "The first reward the exerciser of forbearance gets is that people become his helpers against the ignorant."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. In the traditions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find this concept of the heart. Now, in many traditions, we find that the heart is considered the place where Allah resides. And we also find that the heart is the place where the love for Allah exists. Now, we find, again, in the traditions and in the Holy Quran in general, that we must protect this heart. And of course, when it comes to the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find this perfect heart, this heart which has reached a kamal, a perfection, a completion, a completeness, which leads towards ultimate perfection. Now, this heart, again, it must be protected. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when talking about this heart, he says that if despair, hopelessness, al-yas, overtakes the heart, successive regrets will kill it, and the anger of the heart will be intensified. And so here, dear brothers, we find that this is the truth, right? Well, one of the greatest sins, and of course in the book Greater Sins by Ayatollah Dastaghayb Shirazi, Shaheed Ayatollah Dastaghayb Shirazi, we find that he speaks about despair being one of the greater sins. Now, despairing in the mercy of Allah, despairing in the help of Allah, despairing in the victory of Allah. So in general, it means that we believe or we imagine that the troubles and tribulations and problems and hardships that we face in life are so great that even Allah either can't help us or he won't help us. And in both cases, we end up despairing from the help of Allah, the victory of Allah, the mercy of Allah, the forgiveness of Allah. Now, when this despair overtakes our heart, Imam Ali says, successive regrets will kill it. Right? So the first step in this road towards destruction and ruin and depression and anguish and anger and frustration and regret and all these negative emotions, the first step is despair. We cannot save ourselves. Allah will not save us. Allah cannot save us. Allah will not forgive us. Allah will not find us a solution to our problems. And what happens is that then successive regrets come. Well, why didn't Allah help me? Allah should have helped me. This didn't happen. That didn't happen. This didn't get accomplished. That didn't get accomplished. This negative regret continuously, because it stems upon despair, starts to kill the heart. And eventually, the heart becomes so filled with despair and regret over the past and even perhaps the present that it is overwhelmed with anger, and anger is a constant companion for a human being. And it's not really a companion. More than a companion, it's a constant torment for a human being. For as it is also related in the traditions, the anger hurts the individual themselves more than it hurts anybody else. And so, in order to protect this heart and make sure that it remains the abode of the Almighty Allah and that the love for Allah increases one way or the other, as Imam Ali says, do not let despair overtake your heart. Do not let successive regrets kill your heart. And of course, do not inflame and ruin your heart via anger. Another profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program. And at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen. I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him, and you